From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, the story of the day Malcolm X hung out with Richard Holbrooke and the rediscovered recording that was thought lost for 50 years.
Mr. Moderator and Miss Pierce, and to the Brown Daily Herald, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, that takes in everybody.
Plus, he's looking more and more like the nominee, but who is the real Mitt Romney? And later, how top banks and consulting firms recruit the best and the brightest students.
Instead of just drawing in, say, MBAs, the thing that's different now is that it's drawing in scientists and engineers and mathematicians.
Also, boxing legend Sugar Ray Leonard remembers his friend and trainer Angelo Dundee, who died earlier this week. And singer-songwriter Jill Sobule takes on three sacred cows, Ivy Singer, Barbara Streisand, and Yentl.
You know, if you read the book, and there was no word for it back then, but I think Yentl was transgender.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Our next story came to us from Malcolm Burnley. He's a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And last semester, he took a narrative writing course. And one of the assignments was to write a fictional story based on something true, but that true event had to be found inside the university archives.
So I went to the archives and started flipping through dusty compilations of student newspapers. And there was this old black and white photo of when Malcolm X came to speak. But there was one short article that corresponded to it and very little else.
May 11th, 1961, Malcolm X came to speak at Brown University. And Malcolm Burnley noticed that at the end of that story, there was a brief mention of another article, also from the Brown student newspaper, this one written by a senior named Catherine Pierce, and her essay was the reason Malcolm X wanted to visit Brown.
So I immediately started asking her what she remembered about provoking Malcolm X to come, as the paper said, and she slowly started remembering the story of what happened.
I just felt that integration was a better path, more reasonable and with a greater chance of success.
That is Catherine Pierce. Today, she lives about an hour north of New York City. When she was a student in 1961, she believed the Nation of Islam's message of separation of the races was destructive. So she wrote a detailed critique, and somehow it caught the attention of the Nation of Islam.
Then about 2 weeks after, representatives of the Nation of Islam called the Brown Daily Herald. They said that Malcolm X wanted to come to Brown to defend his views because Catherine's essay was so critical of the organization.
Well, I think we were quite astonished.
The editor of the student newspaper was a 19-year-old named Richard Holbrooke. Yes, that Richard Holbrooke, the late legendary diplomat.
Holbrooke and his staff agreed with the Nation of Islam that they would like to have Malcolm here. But then the trick was convincing the university administration.
The university was worried about possible violence, worried about upsetting the NAACP, which had pressured other universities, including UC Berkeley and Howard, the historically black university, to prevent Malcolm X from speaking on their campuses that year. Holbrooke met with Brown president Barnaby Keeney at least six times to try and convince him.
Richard, as usual, said, "What have we got to be afraid of? It's better that we let him speak, and it's better that the students make up their own minds than that we shut him out."
Cotty Martin is Richard Holbrooke's widow. According to Malcolm Burnley, Holbrooke took a hard line with the administration. If they didn't agree to allow Malcolm X to speak at Brown, Holbrooke would move the student newspaper off campus and break its ties to the university.
But in typical Holbrooke fashion, he prevailed. He used to recall walking with Malcolm X and his gigantic bodyguards from Richard's office in the Brown Daily Herald to the auditorium where the students waited. And that walk left a deep impression on Richard, who even as a 19-year-old, was already a budding historian.
Catherine Pierce, who wrote the essay that prompted the visit, recently unearthed a recording of that night, a recording she kept in a box in her attic for 50 years. This is the first time it has ever been broadcast, an extraordinary historical record, an early window into Malcolm X's evolving views and the young future diplomat who would bring him to campus. Here, then, is 19-year-old Richard Holbrooke.
On behalf of the Brown Daily Herald, I welcome all of you to Sales Hall. Tonight we present two different viewpoints on the American Negro and his future.
Malcolm X and his entourage purchased 200 tickets for Nation of Islam members from Boston to train down. So you can hear in the audience there is between 100 and 200 Nation of Islam members in attendance.
Catherine Pierce was allowed to make a brief statement right after Richard Holbrooke.
For those of us who feel that the Negro is an integral part of our culture, and to advocate integration because we believe in the equality of all men, the black Muslims are an indication of the fact that we have not done enough acting to make our position acceptable to the Negro dissatisfied with his present situation.
And a few minutes later, she introduced the main speaker.
I now turn the platform over to Minister Malcolm X Shabazz.
Moderator and Ms. Pierce, and to the Brown Daily Herald, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, that takes in everybody.
Malcolm X was supposed to debate a representative from the NAACP that night. He was representing the Nation of Islam, of course, and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. But in the last minute, the NAACP representative, Herbert Wright, backed out.
So, kind of on the fly, Malcolm had to prepare a speech for that evening. And he reveals a lot of his ideology and positions that are dated to years later in his life.
So the question today is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad a bona fide religious leader, and are his followers a bona fide religious group? And this is a question that America has got to come face to face with.
At several points, you hear raucous applause, clearly from the Nation of Islam members, based on the point that Malcolm X makes. And at other points you hear, he kind of plays to the white audience and he gets them laughing.
They don't have a history of their own, so they let you tell them what their history is. And that, in essence, is that you found them in the jungle someplace with a spear chasing white people in a cannibalistic way to try and give the impression that white meat is the only good meat to eat.
And you also hear gasps at certain points in the recording at a few moments.
No follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad partakes of any alcoholic beverage, narcotic, reefers, or tobacco, which is prevalent in the Negro communities across the country, even right here in the city of Providence. He has reformed us of these things, and we used to do all of them abundantly. I myself was one of the foremost practicers or doers of everything that I've mentioned here so far, and the teachings, telling you the truth, and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad stopped me from doing these things overnight.
At several points, he references the 725 million Muslims across the world versus the 20 million so-called Negroes in America.
There are 20 million so-called Negroes here in America, 20 million ex-slaves, 20 million second-class citizens. No matter what other classification you try and put on them, you can't deny that we are ex-slaves. You can't deny that we're a second-class citizens.
And the Nation of Islam refused the term Negro. They said it was the white man's classification of black Americans. So that's why he said so-called Negro.
Malcolm Burnley interviewed dozens of people who witnessed the speech that night, and they all recalled being riveted, even if they didn't agree with what Malcolm X had to say. Here's Catherine Pierce again.
He read his audience very, very well, as a fine public speaker does.
And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad feel that when you try and pass integration laws here in America, forcing white people to pretend that they are accepting black people, what you are doing is making white people act in a hypocritical way. However, we feel that when you can change both of them and they come together voluntarily, without force or without pressure, then automatically you are furthering brotherhood and bringing about better relationship between the two races.
The entire speech lasted just under 1 hour.
It began at about 8 p.m., and after the Q&A, it extended until about 10:30. But afterwards, Malcolm X actually went to the student lounge, and he invited any of the students who wanted to talk with him more to come and speak with him. And at that point, he conducted an interview with these white young white students, and he was willing to greet them more intimately and in private. And obviously, he was seeking publicity, and he wanted to be as well-known as possible, but I don't know, it definitely is a gesture to make towards young white students who, by all accounts, he wouldn't really want to have anything to do with, but he was willing to greet them and talk to them in private.
Malcolm Burnley did eventually write that narrative account of the incident for his class assignment. He's also writing a much longer version. Though Cottie Martin says her husband, Richard Holbrook, often spoke about the story, it's unclear whether he ever wrote it down. Holbrook was planning to write his memoirs at the time of his death in December 2010. The journalist George Packer is working on a biography right now. And as for Brown University?
In my research, there's no mention in the university calendar for that year or in President Kinney's notes of Malcolm X coming. It's essentially just been whitewashed from the university records.
But as Malcolm Burnley reports, that's now about to change. Today, it's Nevada's turn, and the inevitability question is creeping back, as in, is Mitt Romney the inevitable GOP nominee? But just who is Mitt Romney? That's our cover story today. The former Massachusetts governor is expected to do very well in Nevada. And then the next big test comes at the end of the month when Arizona and Michigan hold their primaries, contests Romney is also favored to win. In a few minutes, we'll get an update from Ari Shapiro, who is covering the Nevada caucuses. We'll also hear the latest on the violence in Syria and today's UN resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China. But first, to Mitt Romney, a man who, to some, personifies the corporate raider, the cold, calculating chief executive, the person who occasionally says things like this.
I like being able to fire people who provide services to me.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there.
Corporations are people, my friend.
But there's another side to Mitt Romney, a side that people who know him say just doesn't seem to come out.
He was sort of like the image of a Boy Scout, what a Boy Scout should be.
That's Garrett Rasmussen. He's a partner at the Orrick Law Firm and was a classmate of Romney's at Harvard Law School.
You know, he's clean. He was well-dressed. He was earnest. He was polite. He was certainly entirely sincere and trustworthy and focused. So he wasn't the type of kid that we saw a lot of in colleges. And I attributed that mostly to, I guess, coming from Utah.
Here's how Jeff Rennert, a former colleague at Bain Capital, describes Romney.
He's the most capable person I've known. He is a guy who wakes up at 6 in the morning and goes till midnight and has tremendous energy, tremendous intellect, ability to focus on the detail, ability to go see the big picture, and he's able to work with very bright, very capable people to get them to pull together in the same direction for a common purpose.
Alan Sievers feels much the same way. She worked with Romney when he was put in charge of the Boston area Mormon churches.
I thought he was quite innovative in the way he worked with that large group of congregations because some were quite wealthy and had a lot of talent in them, and some of them had a lot of new converts and especially low-income people, ethnic groups. And I think he did a really innovative job figuring out how to distribute talent and leadership and build up the capacities of the weaker congregations.
Helen Sievers, by the way, is not planning to vote for Mitt Romney if he is the nominee. She's a Democrat, but she still respects him as a leader. But even among those who have known Romney, like Jeff Rennert, very few can say they really know him well.
He's got a lot on his plate. He doesn't have a lot of idle time for hanging out. You know, he's not a guy who lounges around, puts his feet up on the couch and, you know, goes on cruise control while he, sips a beer. The guy he's going hard. He's, when he was at Bain Capital, he was building a great organization that was the leader in its industry, even though none of us had been in the industry, so we had to figure it out. At the same time, he had 5 young sons who he was helping raise and had, enormous personal commitments to his church and his community. But the guy gives a lot of himself, so he's just a very, very unusual person who was raised with a set of values and work ethic and has an energy level that keeps him in motion all the time.
The Boston Globe reporters Scott Hellman and Michael Cranish wanted to build a deeper profile of Romney. They recently released their book. It's called The Real Romney, and in it they explain why they believe Romney lacks a bit of the common touch.
Well, you know, he grew up in a series of bubbles. He grew up in a very wealthy community in Michigan. He was a Mormon missionary, went to Brigham Young University for the last 3 years of his college. And then he was at Harvard Business School and Law School, and then in private equity. These are all very insular, elite worlds. He did not run, for example, for the city council. He wasn't a mayor. So he's not the sort of glad-handing politician with the common touch in that way. That's really not who he is. He's not a bomb thrower. Now, running for president, he needs to show that he can connect. And he's certainly had some problems over the years in doing that. And it really is one of the greatest challenges that he faces still.
In the book, you guys write, he has little patience for idle chatter or small talk, little interest in mingling at cocktail parties, at social functions, or even in the crowded hallway. That seems like a little bit of an impediment for somebody who wants to be in politics, isn't it?
Absolutely. I was thinking the other day of one of the Republican governor's events that I was at down in Florida with Haley Barbour, the former Mississippi governor.
A guy who loves small talk.
He's walking around with a drink in his hand, and he's chatting with everybody in sight, rubbing elbows, how you doing? Mitt Romney is the absolute opposite of that. I mean, he could not be any more different than that type of politician. And you're right, it is a huge impediment. And what's interesting is if you look back over his career, he's had this problem the whole way. In 1994, he was very stiff on the campaign trail. And today, even as we're talking, he continues to make these comments that just suggest that he doesn't know how to connect with people. And he has to figure out that common touch if he's the nominee.
Who are his friends? Who are the people that consider themselves to be close friends of Mitt Romney? What do they tell you about him?
He has a very small circle of people who he relies on. That would include his family. He's very close to his advisors, people who've been in with him for years. He has had people who worked with him as governor and in his campaigns and current campaign. When he went to be governor, he took people from his business and had them work with him in the governor's office. So there's a certain distance that he maintains outside of that very small circle.
Is he somebody who always saw himself as a future politician, and did he operate that way as a young man?
I think so. I mean, I've heard him say, I never imagined myself running for president, but a lot of people say he always imagined himself running for president. His father had run unsuccessfully, and he wanted to succeed where his father failed. There's an anecdote in the book where he's a young teenager. He's at the state capitol in Lansing, Michigan, and his father's governor. And it's after midnight, and he comes in, and according to this story that was told at the time, Mitt's suggesting to his father how he might want to handle some recalcitrant legislators. Like I said earlier, he didn't run for the smaller offices. He was always looking pretty high, if not the presidency, one of the top offices beneath that.
Let me ask you guys about the faith, the issue, because, of course, we have to assume that this is going to be looked at more and more over the course of the campaign, especially if Romney becomes the nominee. But I wonder, if Mitt Romney were a devout Catholic or a devout Episcopalian or the other mainline Protestant denomination, and he held an equally important role, would we be asking those questions?
I think that's an excellent question. And the answer, from my perspective, is I don't know. I mean, it is hard to make comparisons across faith because positions are different. There's not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison. I mean, for example, in the Mormon Church, Mitt Romney was a bishop, and then he was a stake president. That's sort of like akin to being a pastor and then being the head of a Catholic diocese, to continue with that analogy. And, I mean, by definition, if you're a Mormon lay leader, you're a lay leader. So you're not a paid clergyman. You're a businessman. You're a professor. You're a teacher who happens to take on these roles. So in some sense, it feels unfair to sort of hold him to a different standard. But I think you're right that he's going to be confronted with all these questions about what his faith means to him and how it informs his values. And typically how he's dealt with these things is to say, if you want to know about doctrine or anything gets into that vein, go ask the church. I'm not a spokesman for my church.
How central is the Mormon Church in his life?
It is such a big part of his life and has been for some time. I mean, you have to remember when you grow up in a very observant Mormon household, it's not just where you go on Sundays. It's your social life, and it informs your cultural values, and you have all these events during the week. So it's such a big percentage, even time-wise, of the way you spend your week. And yet, you know, Mitt Romney clearly is uncomfortable talking about his faith in a really significant way. And so I think one result of that is people feel like they don't fully know him because he's not sharing this big part of himself.
And yet he is a major figure in the church, right?
He held very important leadership roles before he got into politics. His family was very important in the history of Mormonism, the spread of Mormonism in the 19th century. So absolutely, I mean, you can't understand him without understanding his faith, and yet he more or less walls that off from view, and I think it'll be fascinating, assuming he's the nominee, to watch how that happens in the general election.
What does his time as governor tell us about the kind of president he would be?
It's fascinating. He doesn't talk about it at all, but he can point to certainly some successes in working with a Democratic legislature. I realize that we might not have a Democratic Congress if he were to win, but he has shown to be able to work with the other side, most notably on health care. This was a major achievement that remains popular and by most measures pretty successful in terms of achieving near universal coverage here. So I think he would come in as he did as governor. He would come in as an outsider, somebody who is not beholden to, you know, special interests or does not have long-term relationships with lobbyists or other lawmakers. He might not even know their names. He comes in as the CEO. He's going to take charge, and he's going to lay out an agenda and, you know, push it through.
It seems like the picture that comes out about Mitt Romney from this book is somebody who is fairly detached, either detached or he only really shows himself to one or two people, maybe his wife and his kids. And I wonder, does it matter? I mean, does a president have to be, you know, have to bare their soul? I mean, of course, President Obama wrote this memoir, which is excellent and touching and introspective. But I wonder, I mean, do you think that matters?
I think it matters when you're running for president. For example, one of his key supporters, Chris Christie, said recently that Mitt Romney is, quote, very reserved and needs to work on connecting with people. If you're very reserved and yet running for president, those two things seem to be a disconnect. It's one of his greatest challenges. And that's sometimes why he makes comments that people perceive as gaffes about, he's not worried about poor people. Clearly he is, but he just couldn't state it in a way that makes sense to the regular person.
But I think it matters as president, too, because if you think about all these intangibles that come up, I mean, whether it's you're meeting with a foreign leader over some delicate situation or, you know, you're talking to the mother of who just lost a kid in Iraq or Afghanistan. There are all kinds of situations where you have to be able to connect with people and have that sort of emotional intelligence to be able to judge people and to know what to say and to know not what to say. So I think it's critical that if he were to win, that he be able to figure that out, because I do think it's a critical part of leadership.
That's Scott Hellman. He's the author of The Real Romney. We also spoke with Michael Cranish, his co-author. Both of them are reporters for the Boston Globe. Michael Cranish, Scott Hellman, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last May, Marina Keegan, a student at Yale University, got an email from one of the largest hedge funds in the world, Bridgewater. And the email politely stated,
"We noticed that you didn't apply for our internship this summer, and we'd love to talk to you about why. If you meet us here at this time, and we will compensate you for your time with $100.
$100 just to tell him why she didn't want the job. Since her sophomore year at Yale, Marina has been bombarded with emails from banks, consulting firms, and hedge funds begging her to consider working for them. Same, by the way, with all her friends. And Marina is an English major. Anyway, she decided to take Bridgewater up on their offer.
You're like, I'll take $100.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of students did that. And it was only sort of once I was inside the room that I realized, oh my gosh, maybe I'm helping them perfect their recruiting machine, which is exactly what we were doing.
Bridgewater confirmed to us that it actually does hold these focus groups. It's a small but telling window into the way big banks and consulting companies recruit at top-tier schools. And last year, at some Ivy League schools, up to half of the graduates went into finance or consulting. And it's a kind of brain drain that may end up hurting our economy in ways we won't see for years. Even President Obama weighed in on it at a speech in December.
And by the way, if we don't have an economy that's built on bubbles and financial speculation, our best and brightest won't all gravitate towards careers in banking and finance. Because if we want an economy that's built to last, we need more of those young people in science and engineering.
Our cover story today, the brain drain to finance and consulting, the consequences and signs that it may be ending. Now, shortly after Marina went to the Bridgewater Focus Group, she wrote about it in a Yale student magazine, and she found out that a quarter of her classmates were heading into banking and consulting. She was surprised and even a little angry, and it turns out she's not the only one. Reporter Craig LaMoult from member station WSHU went to Yale to find out how widespread the anti-finance and consulting backlash has become at some universities.
Take a stance! Don't go into finance! Take a stance!
These kinds of protests have been springing up on some of the most elite campuses in the country. Student protesters got into a Goldman Sachs recruitment session at Princeton and can be seen in a YouTube video addressing the student attendees in the call-and-response mic check style of the Occupy movement.
What you've been listening to is a carefully crafted recruitment pitch.
What you've been listening to is a carefully crafted recruitment pitch.
You can do better for yourself.
Similar protests have been held at Harvard and at Stanford, where Taryn Norris was a student. Norris and a classmate wrote an op-ed in the student paper.
When we sort of saw the Occupy Wall Street movement rise this fall and saw that this was an issue that the nation was really taking seriously, we felt like it was a really important time to step out and say, you know, this is how we think this is impacting universities across the country and why it's relevant to students today.
After he wrote the op-ed, Norris teamed up with a politically focused network for young people called Our Time to expand on that idea. They started the Stop the Brain Drain campaign to call attention to the issue and encourage public service and entrepreneurism as an alternative to the financial world. Norris stresses they're not against all financial institutions.
But the problem is that when you've got 20 to 30% of some of the top talent in this country going into a sector that is not necessarily contributing to economic and social productivity, then that's a problem for the country at large, and it's something that we should all be concerned about.
According to university surveys of the class of 2010, more than half of respondents from the University of Pennsylvania are working either in finance or consulting. At Harvard, it was 49%, and more than a third of respondents at Cornell started out their careers in the field. Norris says so many idealistic young people start college wanting to change the world.
And then 4 years later, they're going to work for Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. What is going on there? I think that's what we're trying to figure out and trying to address.
Goldman Sachs declined to be interviewed for this story. Morgan Stanley sent a written statement saying, quote, "Because a healthy banking and capital markets system is vital to economic growth, joining the industry at this time is a unique chance to shape how we contribute to a healthy economic environment." The Stop the Brain Drain campaign is only partly about the demand for new finance employees. It's also targeting the supply, and that focuses their attention on the career development centers at the top universities. They say the schools are too focused on funneling graduates into these jobs. Career centers at several schools say they confer employer-in-residence status on some employers. That gets them discounts on fees for on-campus events, and those events are promoted to students through emails, online job databases, and social networking. Allison Moore is the director of the Career Services Office at Yale.
The vast majority of organizations that recruit on campus here at Yale and at other college campuses across the country are definitely within financial services and management consulting.
Moore says they're just really good at working with career centers. She says the percentage of Yale students going into business and finance dropped last year, in part because with the economy, firms have been scaling back their hiring. On a chilly evening recently, Yale junior Jordan Oros walked out of a recruiting session that was hosted by the consulting firm Bain & Company. She says the protests and op-eds have raised a topic that students weren't talking about before.
You know, I think it's a really great movement, and I think that it really has started a lot of great conversations on campus about what we are doing with our time and what we are deciding to do with the opportunities that Yale's given us.
Oros says growing up, she wanted to be an astronaut. But now that the space program isn't as active as it used to be, she's thinking consulting is looking like a pretty good second choice.
That's reporter Craig LaMoult in New Haven. Economist Paul Kodrowski says elite schools have been sending a bigger share of their graduates into finance and consulting for at least two decades. That's not new. But what's different now, he says, is that those students have essentially used their talents to grow the financial sector and in ways, he says, are unhealthy for the overall economy.
So that's one, is that it's grown as a proportion of the economy in a way that we haven't seen since the years leading up to the Great Depression. And then the second thing that's gone on that's really unusual is that it's drawing in scientists and engineers and mathematicians, pulling in all of these very bright people and moving them to a use that no one really ever imagined.
Well, what are the consequences of that, if any?
Oh, they're immense. So, you know, one of the strangest puzzles in sort of recent economics of entrepreneurship is why the rate at which we create young companies in the United States is actually flatlined, despite, you know, immense increase in venture capital, all kinds of entrepreneurship programs around the United States. We're spending so much more, and yet we're not seeing any benefit. And so one of the reasons why is because of these entrepreneurs, in particular in science, engineering, and mathematics, getting yanked off into the financial sector, never to be seen again.
I mean, I'm just thinking about the last sort of 10 years. I mean, the iPod and Facebook and Google and all of these incredible innovations. That doesn't seem to reflect what you're arguing.
No, but you have to sort of look at it the other way around and say, how quickly has productivity grown over the period compared to prior decades? And the answer is slower. How quickly has the economy grown? And the answer is slower. One of the more remarkable things in last week's jobs data was, for the first time, a sharp, sharp decline in employment in the financial sector. So despite rapid gains in almost every sector of the economy, including, you know, wonderfully manufacturing, which is, you know, hugely important, we finally saw the beginnings of a contraction. Not to do with the crisis, but to do with a restructuring and a change in the role of financial services in the U.S. economy. And I think it points to a much happier future for the U.S. economy.
That's economist Paul Kodrosky. Okay, here's a pop quiz courtesy of David Leonhardt, the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. What do the CEOs of Boeing, GE, Morgan Stanley, the Prime Minister of Israel, Chelsea Clinton, and R&B star John Legend all have in common?
They all worked for one of the three big, most prestigious consulting firms, which would be BCG.
Boston Consulting Group.
Yep. Bain, which is where Mitt Romney spent a few years before going to Bain Capital.
Right.
And McKinsey. All of them.
What did John Legend do there? Do you know?
I don't really. I mean, he spent a few years there.
Leonhardt says consulting, like finance, is still the top career choice on many elite campuses, but it's no longer gaining in popularity as it did all through the 1990s.
I think some students are saying, wait a second, if I want to make money, I want to make real money, and they're going to hedge funds. Mm. And I do think there are probably some students who are basically taking the advice of the president of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust, who's saying, hey, you know, I talk to a lot of students who tell me they don't actually enjoy this work. You know, I think probably on the margins, you have a few kids on either end, some of whom want to go make more money and some of whom realize they don't actually want to do this.
To me, one of the most glaring statistics to come out of the financial crisis was the extent to which the financial sector was such a huge part of our economy.
Yes.
I wonder if some of that creativity went into some of the, let's say, destructive creativity that we saw on Wall Street in the 2000s, you know, credit default swaps and so on.
Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman, had this line that drove people in finance absolutely nuts. He said, the only invention from modern finance that has improved people's lives is the ATM. Because, of course, high finance didn't spend a lot of time working on the ATM, right? If you think about how much finance has expanded as a share of our economy, and then you say, show me the fruits of that. Show me the way that has improved our lives. Well, you can't point to a huge number of ways in which it has. To be clear, you can create enormous social good in the right environment at an investment bank or a consulting firm. Maybe you are at an investment bank and you steer an investment to its most productive use, which is a cure for a disease. Maybe you're at a consulting firm and you help a pharmaceutical company figure out a new way to do things that makes life a lot better for people. It's a matter of scale. But one of the interesting things is people now asking, wait a second, do the people who go into these fields actually enjoy it? There is no doubt that some number of them do. But I think you can make a pretty good argument that more people go into this field than enjoy it, which is another way of saying more people go into this field than probably should.
David Leonhardt, Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. We also heard from Paul Kodrosky of the Kauffman Foundation. By the way, Marina Keegan, the Yale student we heard from earlier, she's graduating in May, and she is actually heading to New York, but not to Wall Street, as a playwright, and a play of hers is going up at a festival in New York this summer. What did you do with $100?
I don't remember.
You didn't, like, blow it on a bottle of champagne and caviar.
Yeah, I invested it in a hedge fund.
Behind every great boxer is a great trainer. The man behind 15 championship boxers was Angelo Dundee. Over a 60-year period, he worked with the best, including two living legends, Muhammad Ali and Sugar Ray Leonard. Angelo Dundee died this week at the age of 90 at his home in Tampa, Florida. We called up Sugar Ray Leonard to ask him how he ended up connecting with a man who would eventually become his mentor and, of course, his corner man.
When I won the gold medal in 1976 in the Olympics, I had no intentions of turning professional. But once that decision was made, I was told to get Angelo Dundee, and that was through the advice of Muhammad Ali. And he said to me, if you turn professional, the guy to get is Angelo Dundee because he has the right connections and the right complexion. I didn't quite know what that meant, but I did select Angelo. And from day one, I knew I had made the right decision to have him in my corner throughout my career.
What was he like as a corner man?
He was very clever in what he would say, the advice he would give in the corner. He never showed signs of desperation or frustration. He would say the perfect sound bites that really activated my reserve when the fight was close. He said the right things at the right time. That was Angelo Dundee style.
I'm curious to know what he said to you in 1979. This is after you won your biggest match to date at that point. It was a WBC welterweight fight. You beat Wilfred Benitez, and it was obviously a grueling match down to almost to the bitter end. It was called in your favor with just 6 seconds left on the clock. What did Dundee say to you after you won? You got the title.
That fight took so much out of me because I never stopped throwing punches. I tried to throw as many punches as I possibly could. And Angelo just said after the fight, great job. And that solidified that I won the fight.
Hmm. And then, of course, there was that famous moment in 1981. You're fighting Tommy Hearns. He gets down to the end of round 12, and you are losing the fight. You go back to the corner, and this is what Angelo Dundee says to you.
You're blowing it now, son. You're blowing it.
He says, Sugar Ray, you're blowing it, son. You're blowing it. Well, tell me what you were thinking about at that moment.
I wasn't thinking about too many things. I was too tired to think.
Yeah.
I mean, I was totally spent. I mean, it was over 100 degrees in that ring. You're so exhausted. Your legs, your lungs, everything's burning and on fire. And at that point, most guys will quit. And Angelo said, you're blowing it, you're blowing it, which made me just get up there and try one more time. And with that little boost of confidence, with that little boost of, let's do it, I won the title.
This is what Muhammad Ali said about Angelo Dundee back in the 70s. He was on the Phil Donahue show.
See, a real trainer, when he gets a real fighter, he don't have to train him. Just coach him on what to do and who he's fighting, what type of style to fight, what to look for.
Did you find that to be true, that he wasn't necessarily telling you what to do, but he would advise you, and he would say things to you that he knew about other people that you didn't know?
This is so amazing because I've never heard this audio. The fact that Angelo didn't really train me per se, but we would work on strategies and tactics and things that would be effective at the time, because he was the best corner man. As far as taking care of cuts and what have you. He was also great with the media. Angelo was just the perfect guy for these huge events.
Some people call him the greatest ambassador for boxing. What do people mean by that?
He respected the sport. He loved the sport. He was passionate about the sport. Angie was good for boxing.
Well, Sugar Ray Leonard, thank you so much for your remembrances.
Thank you.
That's the legendary boxing champ, Sugar Ray Leonard, remembering his trainer and corner man, Angelo Dundee. Dundee died this past week at the age of 90. It's time now for music, and this is a story of how the troubadour Jill Sobule may be picking a fight with Barbara Streisand. But before we get to that, Jill Sobule is probably best known for her 1995 hit single, I Kissed a Girl.
So we left, compared notes. We had a drink, we had a smoke. She took off her overcoat. I kissed a girl.
These days, Jill Sobule is sticking with that theme just a little, but her focus is on the gender-bending play by Isaac Bashevis singer, Yentl.
Papa, can you hear me? Papa, can you see me?
Okay, if this is the Yentl you're thinking of, and I admit I was, it is nothing like the short story and play written by I.B. Singer. Barbra Streisand turned it into a musical, much to Singer's dismay. Jill Sobule was asked by a theater in Sarasota, Florida, to compose brand new music for a revival of the original play. It had its debut a few weeks ago, and if you are expecting Yentl to sing, well, Sobule's version is a little more Singer and a little less Barbra.
What got me into reading the short story, the I.B. Singer, was I read an interview with him right after the movie in the New York Times.
And it's devastating.
It's hysterically mean.
That's right. In fact, I have it right in front of me. He's asked, have you seen the movie Yentl? He says, yes, I have seen it. Did you like it? I am sorry to say I did not. He goes on to really to attack, scathingly attack Barbra Streisand.
And I think he died not too long after.
So would you say that this is this version is more faithful to I.B. Singer's short story and then subsequent play, or is this closer to Barbra Streisand's?
Oh, no. She changed the ending and made it kind of funny girl coming to America.
She doesn't go to America in this version.
She does not go to America. You know, we keep to the word. And, you know, if you read the book, and there was no word for it back then, but I think Yentl was transgender. I mean, it's several times in the book where she says, the father says to her, you have the soul of a man and a body of a woman.
Hmm. And in the film, it was sort of seen as a statement of feminism, right?
As a statement of feminism. And that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie when she turns into Anshul, the boy, and there's this soft focus, and you see Barbra, and she's in the men's clothing, but it kind of focuses on her perfectly manicured Beverly Hills nails. You know, it's like, that doesn't happen here.
We should, I guess, make it clear that in this play, Yentl never sings. I mean, all the music in the play is sort of like a Greek chorus, right?
Right.
Or Jewish chorus.
It's a Greek-Jewish, yes, Jewish
right.
chorus.
At one point, the singers sing a song called Tomorrow is Breaking My Heart, and it sounds like a love song.
After the fall, the music begins. We dance to our luck. We are already sinners. We never think the sun will rise. We just keep burning through the night. Tomorrow is
what is this one about?
I think this is towards the end when the jig is up, when Yentl, she knows she's going to be exposed, and she feels that it's time to move on. She can't live this lie anymore. So it's really kind of the goodbye song.
Everything is gonna be the same.
Nothing that we are will ever change. We'll never change. Tomorrow is breaking. Tomorrow is breaking. Tomorrow is breaking. My heart.
I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Jill Sobule. She's recently composed original music for a new production of Yentl, which is now being performed in Sarasota, Florida. Jill, there's a moment at the end of the play, shortly after Yentl's father dies, and we hear the song Last Candle.
Yes, the Papa Can You Hear Me moment.
That's the Papa Can You Hear Me moment.
Yes.
I watch you rise. I watch you rise and pray that you're still watching and you can hear. So give me answers, give me answers, not just tears. Where do I go now? What should I be? Nothing is written for someone like me. It is the last candle for you and me.
When they light that candle, the last candle. It's the wax of the candle is the body, and the flame is the smoke. And as soon as it goes out, the body leaves this world. So I used that imagery. And I also brought in her feeling that she had no choice but to live her life as a boy.
As you burn down, please forgive me or speak up now. Where do I go now? What should I be? Nothing is written.
In that infamous interview that I.B. Singer did with the New York Times in 1984, he says, "Music and singing are not my fields." So he never envisioned music in the stage adaptation of his story, Yentl the Yeshiva Boy. What do you think he would have made of this one?
You know what? I think he would approve of my music. I really do, because it keeps the spirit of the play. And it has a sense of humor. I think he actually would like it because it doesn't feel intrusive.
What about Barbara?
You know, I don't know. I would love to know what she would think. I'm not sure she'd like it. I hope she would.
That's singer-songwriter Jill Sobule. She's composed new music for the Oslo Repertory Theater Company's staging of Yentl in Sarasota, Florida. The play runs through April 26th. Jill Sobule, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Guy.
Jonathan and David in the book of Samuel, they were really close, they were best friends. They made a covenant for the rest of their lives, said their love surpassed those of their wives.
For the week ending February 5th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Tasneem Shama, Megan Kane, and Kenya Young. Lauren Beneshu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. Saturdays and Sundays. And thanks for tuning in.